But the source of this misgiving and this objection is a verse of the Holy Quran, which we're going to recite for you today here on the key. That verse is verse number 34 of Surah Nisa. Surah Nisa, which is the fourth surah of the Holy Quran. In this verse, God Almighty says, the part of the verse that's directly related to our topic at hand is this,
وَاللَّاتِي تَخَافُونَ نُشُوزَهُنَّ فَإِذُوهُنَّ وَاهْجُرُوهُنَّ فِي الْمَضَاجِ وَضْرِبُوهُنَّ.
The translation of this verse goes as follows. As for those wives whose misconduct you fear, first advise them. And if ineffective, keep away from them in the bed. And as the last resort, beat them. Then, if they obey you, do not seek any course of action against them. A lot of people say that this verse propagates violence towards women, and it allows a man to beat his wife, which affirms the general idea that Islam is a violent religion. It's an anti-feminist religion. It's against women. It doesn't allow women the same rights as men, and so on and so forth. So the question we want to ask today is regarding this verse. We want to examine this verse, and inshallah, and some probably we're going to be continuing this discussion in some of our forthcoming sessions. All right. So you looked at you heard the translation of the verse. Now let's examine the verse in general and see what exactly it says. First of all, in order to understand this verse, we need to understand a word that has been mentioned in the verse, which is nushuz.
Wallati takhafuna nushuzuhunna.
What does this word mean? This word basically, according to Quranic commentators, it refers to the idea that a woman would prevent her husband, would not allow her husband to, benefit from her in a physical manner, right? And to prevent him from establishing sexual relations with her husband, right? So without any valid reason. And we're not talking about the case where Muslim, for example, the woman is sick, or physically there's some ailment with her, or is there some problem where she cannot freely allow her husband to enjoy sexual relations with her. But in the case where there is no other, there's no valid excuse, if such a woman prevents her husband from doing so, they call this nushuz. So therefore, this verse, it's specifically related to this case, and it's not related to, let's say, the case where a woman would disobey her husband as far as performing her other household duties, other household activities are concerned, such as cleaning the house, taking care of her kids, and so on and so forth. According to Islamic jurisprudence, a husband doesn't have any right over his wife. As far as these activities and responsibilities are concerned, and the wife is not religiously responsible to perform them, and if she denies the performance of them, her husband doesn't have any right upon her, and he cannot beat her from this point of view. Imam Raza alayhi salam said,
وَالزَّرْبُ بِالسِّوَاكْ وَشِبْهِهِ زَرْبًا رَفِيقًا.
The Imam said that this person should hit his wife with a siwak. A siwak is a small piece of wood, and even bigger than a toothbrush, for example. And also the Imam adds that the act of hitting should be very, very lenient, and it shouldn't be very powerful. It shouldn't cause any kind of physical harm to the wife. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at violence against women and a right of a husband to beat his wife. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
in the limelight.
Children also seem to be able to clear SARS-CoV-2 from their bodies much quicker than adults can, says Smriti Malapati, writer, in an article published under the heading, Kids Show Mysteriously Low Levels of COVID Antibodies. Here's the story. Children infected with SARS-CoV-2 are less likely than adults to produce antibodies against the virus, despite having similar symptoms and levels of virus in their bodies, according to a small study in Australia. Researchers say the findings add to the growing body of evidence suggesting that children have a more robust initial immune response to COVID-19 and can clear the infection quickly, compared with adults. But because antibodies are likely to be important for guarding against reinfection, the findings raise questions about how well protected children might be against future infections. The study published in JAMA Network Open on March 9th looked at 57 children with a median age of 4 and 51 adults with a median age of 37 who tested positive for SARS-CoV-2 between May 10th and October 28, 2020. Participants had mild symptoms such as headaches and fevers or were asymptomatic. The researchers took nose and throat swabs to measure participants' levels of viral RNA and blood samples to check for immunoglobulin G antibodies against the virus. They found that children and adults had similar viral loads, but only 37% of children produced SARS-CoV-2 antibodies compared with 76% of the adults. Previous studies have also seen differing antibody responses in kids compared with adults. An analysis by Donna Farber, an immunologist at Columbia University in New York City, and her colleagues found that adults produce a broader set of antibodies, including more virus-blocking antibodies than children do. Farber says the Australian analysis confirms and extends those findings. Children could be producing fewer antibodies because they have a more robust innate immune response than adults. This is the first line of defense against pathogens and is non-specific. Children could also be better at responding to infections where they enter the body, such as through the throat or nose. This means the body clears the virus quickly and it doesn't hang around to trigger the adaptive response that produces antibodies, says Farber. Other studies, including by Kirsten Mayer, a cellular geneticist at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Hingston, UK, have shown that children mount a stronger and faster response to an infection, and that the innate immune system has an important role in that response. The younger the child, the more likely it is that their innate immune system is driving that response, says Mayer. But Paul Lisiardi, an immunologist at Children's Research Institute in Melbourne and co-author of Australian study, says that when he and his team looked at innate immune cells in a small group of children, they didn't find a stronger response in those who didn't produce antibodies. This is something to look into, he says. The Australian team also measured some participants' levels of immune cells in the blood. They found lower levels of certain classes of antibody-producing memory B cells and memory T cells in children than in adults. This suggests that kids mount less of an adaptive immune response, which is more targeted and generates immune memory, says Betsy Herold, a pediatric infectious disease physician at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. The team worries that if kids have a less vigorous adaptive immune response, that could put them at risk of reinfection. But Harold calls for caution here. We don't have the data yet to make that conclusion. Children might not be as protected from reinfection, but there is still at very low risk of complications from the initial infection, says Mayer. The Australian study also looked only at people who were infected with early variants of SARS-CoV-2, but the results might differ for the more infectious Delta and Omicron variants. In preliminary analysis of people infected with Delta in 2021, Lee Ciardi says he and his team found that most children and adults produced antibodies in response to an infection, which could be because Delta is associated with higher viral loads. The Australian team is now collecting immunological data from people who have been infected with Omicron.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. In this episode, I have to tell you something about purification, or what is better known in Islamic terminology as tazkiyah. The term tazkiyah actually originally means pruning the plant to remove what is harmful for its growth. That is called tazkiyah. And it is a word, it is a term that we usually come across when we discuss about, you know, self-purification. Just as we remove what is harmful for the growth of a plant, we also need to remove and to simply do away with what pollutes our soul. And it is actually the task of a gardener to trim and remove the harmful branches and to provide what the plant needs to grow. There is something to be, for example, cut off, and there is something to be given to it in order for. Just I'm giving you the example of a gardener who takes care of a plant. So in order for a plant to grow, there is something to be cut off and there is something to be given to it. And these dimensions are to be taken into consideration when it comes to human beings as well. When the term is applied to the human personality, it means to beautify it, to remove from it all evil traces and to remove from it the diseases, the spiritual diseases that are obstacles in getting close to Allah and in achieving proximity to Allah. In Islam, the ultimate objective of religion in Sharia, Islamic law, and the real purpose of raising prophets and sending forth prophets from among mankind is performing and teaching tazkiyah. That's the whole and sole objective, the most important purpose of creation. You know, tazkiyah or purification cannot be achieved without, you know, following the teachings of the Prophet. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
We have been created to achieve tazkiyah, to purify ourselves. And then through purification, we can achieve proximity to Allah and we can live a better life and we can live a happy life. Let's not forget that man acts of his own choice and free will. And this is one of the basic differences between, for example, a plant, a tree when it is pruned, and a human who is taught to purify himself. You know, we have been created free. We have been created to act of our own choice and of our own free will. I gave you the example of a tree. The tree has no intention or volition of its own. Actually, it is the gardener who attends to the plant. It is the gardener who cuts off its branches whenever he desires and whenever he wishes. But human beings are not as such, you know. Men are rational agents and they cannot be forced to accept something, especially a moral thing, you know. They cannot be compelled to do something. Man has to act of his own choice, of his own free will, if he is to purify himself, if he wishes to bring changes to his life, and if he wants to purify himself and achieve perfection and live a better life. Something is moral when one acts arbitrary of one's free will. If you are forced to do something, it's not moral. You will not achieve perfection and you will not achieve any reward whatsoever because there is no compulsion in religion. La ikraha fi din, qad tabayyana ar-rushdu min al-ghay. The right is clear from the wrong and there is no compulsion in religion. Innaka la tahdi من أحببت ولكن الله يهدي من يشاء وهو أعلم بالمهتدين. Surely you cannot guide whom you love, but Allah guides whom He pleases, and He knows best the followers of the right way. You know, verse 56 of chapter 28. The most important point that I would like to discuss with you, my dear brothers and sisters, is that man has been created free and he has to act of his own free choice in order to be able to achieve perfection. He cannot achieve perfection by force or through compulsion or by way of, you know, predestination or, you know, predestined determinism. We do not believe in determinism. We do not believe in compulsion, you know. We believe in the middle way, you know, middle path. And we also believe that man is responsible for his acts because he has been created free. So some people may think that because according to the verse, you know, وَهُوَ أَعْلَمُ بِالْمُهْتَدِينَ وَلَكِنَّ اللَّهَ هَدِي مَنْ يَشَاءُ. So the Quran says in that verse which I recited, God purifies whomever he wants. Some people might say that if God is purifying us, why should we make efforts? Why should we strive, you know? That's a misconception, I think. And that's a misconception, a kind of misunderstanding on the part of some people. We are free and we act of our own free will. But we should not think that we are acting independently of Allah. You know, God has given us the power. God has given us the free will. And without these, without power, without free will, we cannot act. These are the gifts we have been bestowed by Allah, of course. We should also understand that tazkiyah cannot be materialized and cannot be achieved without one acting of his own free will.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
And we should also understand the difference between tazkiyah in terms of, let's say, pruning, and tazkiyah in terms of purifying the human soul, you know, when it comes to pruning a plant or a tree. So that's one form of tazkiyah, that's removing the unwanted branches. And tazkiyah in terms of purifying the human soul is that man can engage in self-purification, while a tree or a plant cannot do so. So a tree waits for the gardener to be, you know, to come and to remove the extra unwanted branches. But man does not have to wait. Man has to learn from the teachings, from the Quran, from the teachings of the Prophet, how to purify himself. And self-purification is quite, you know, relevant. And it gives sense in respect of the human beings. When a person, for example, wants to purify himself, he should not wait for someone to teach him. He should not actually always wait for someone, because the teacher, the Prophet, has provided us with light, with guidance. He has to benefit from the guidance, and he should not wait for someone to teach him, to nurture him, and to help him, actually. He should purify his soul himself, and he should embellish it. He should make it, adorn it by himself, and no one else can do it. He himself should take the matter into his own hands and purify himself. That's all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the war between Russia and Ukraine drags on, there are indications that Ukraine has hosted U.S.-funded labs to develop biological weapons. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Victoria Nuland has admitted that Ukraine hosts biological research facilities.
Ukraine has biological research facilities, which, in fact, we are now quite concerned Russian troops, Russian forces may be seeking to gain control of. So we are working with the Ukrainians on how they can prevent any of those research materials from falling into the hands of Russian forces.
So that Victoria Nuland, the guru of the Maidan, who was passing out cookies to the fascist Azov Battalion in 2014 during the coup against the legitimate government, was forced to admit that these facilities were there. She didn't clarify what they were exactly, but she indicated that they were dismantled quickly in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the Russians.
The admission came after Russia published documents showing that Kiev was ordered to urgently eliminate traces of what was deemed as a biological weapons program financed by the Pentagon. The dangerous pathogens across Ukrainian biolab facilities included anthrax, the plague, tularemia, cholera, and other deadly diseases. In the past several days, long-standing fears, which we have expressed repeatedly for years, regarding the development of military biological materials by the United States on the territory of Ukraine under the auspices of the relevant U.S. Special Services, have been confirmed. Earlier, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had found evidence of U.S.-funded biolabs in Ukraine, which had urgently destroyed samples of deadly pathogens when the military offensive started.
I think the United States was caught by surprise now. At first, they've been denying all the accusations that are being made, you know, over the past few months that they're conducting biological warfare research, you've had this incident here, which initially they really couldn't deny.
Russia says U.S. statements about Ukraine's biolabs indicate fears by Washington that the pathogens stored there may fall into the hands of Russian experts. Moscow says they confirmed the U.S.'s violation of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention.
So either through surrogate or directly, the United States seems to have been involved in creating a capability that would give a country, an allied country, or the United States, a possibility to conduct biological warfare, and that, of course, is forbidden by a variety of UN conventions.
Russia says it had been closely monitoring the bioweapons programs that were developed by the Pentagon in post-Soviet countries. Russia has accused the U.S. of working in Ukraine since 2005 and being involved in the construction, modernization, and operation of over a dozen biolabs suitable for storing or working with pathogens, including those used in bioweapons.
The fact that they existed in Ukraine, where there was a almost obsessive concern and hatred, I must say, among some of the leading factions, right-wing factions in the Ukrainian government against Russia, that they, I think, would be quite prepared to use them in a war with someone they considered their deadly foe. And if they did so, it was with the whole backing of the United States who set up these facilities in the first place.
Moscow has expressed deep concerns about these facilities in recent years. Moscow says facilities in Ukraine were developing components for biological weapons, noting that in the near future, the ministry would release its analysis of the received documents. Russia also accuses the U.S. of sponsoring biological labs across a number of former Soviet republics, including Kazakhstan, Armenia, Tajikistan, and Georgia.
The aerospace force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Cosset carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievements strongly suggest that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit as talks in Vienna are still underway is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
The world is closely watching the Russia-Ukraine conflict as it can potentially end in outcomes that would send shockwaves across the globe. Russia launched what it calls a special military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. That came despite weeks of warnings from Western capitals that such a move would bring catastrophic results. The United States and its allies decided not to confront Russia directly and resorted to supporting Ukraine with intelligence and military hardware. They launch another war that isn't fought with bullets or rockets, but affects banks and financial institutions, an economic war. Washington and its allies have announced several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mostly targeting its banks and energy sector. The scrapping of the highly anticipated Nord Stream 2 pipeline project that would transfer Russian gas directly to Germany was among the measures. Moscow has already warned that it could cut its gas supplies to Germany via the Nord Stream 1 pipeline.
The implications of this event on the economy, the implications of this for the Russian economy, I don't think are quite as tragic as some of the Western press would like to have us believe, because I believe that the Russians have a great many more shock absorbers because they are less exposed than many of the Western capitalist economies.
The tensions risk escalating into a wider energy crisis in Europe, which has over the past year experienced shortages of fuel and price hikes. The military conflict and ensuing sanctions are already showing their effects, but not only on Russia. Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak said crude prices could surge to over $300 per barrel if the US and European Union ban imports of oil from Russia. Oil prices have already spiked to close to $140 per barrel, the highest since the 2008 financial crisis. Western sanctions on Moscow, coupled with logistics turmoil, have also shaken markets for other commodities. U.S. wheat futures rose more than 7%, nearing an all-time high amid fears of supply chaos. European wheat has already hit record highs as deepening Western sanctions against Russia fueled concerns about exports from the Black Sea region. Russia is the world's biggest wheat exporter. Russia and Ukraine account for about 29% of global wheat exports. In stock markets, European shares fell to their lowest in a year, with Germany and Italy's benchmark index slipping into a so-called bear market.
The economic impacts of this crisis, of this war, is not something that we're going to be able to that the world will not be able to undo, even if there is a peace treaty in the short term, because the disruptions and the lack of confidence in the old geopolitical arrangements is a permanent damage that will profoundly affect the world economy.
What should be taken into account is that you can't simply remove a cog from the system and expect it to continue working without a hitch. Sanctions might hurt Russia for the short term, but in the long run, everyone will lose.
A U.S. delegation of senior State Department and White House officials traveled to the Venezuelan capital, Caracas, to meet with President Nicolas Maduro's government. The meeting is the highest-level visit by U.S. officials to Venezuela in years. It also coincides with an ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine. The question is, why should such a meeting take place at this time? Venezuela and the U.S. severed all diplomatic relations in 2019 following Washington's recognition of pro-U.S. opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president over the legitimate president Nicolas Maduro. The U.S. then imposed sanctions on individuals with ties to Maduro's government and on companies involved in exporting Venezuelan oil to provoke regime change in the Latin American country. Venezuela soon felt the impact of sanctions as its oil production reduced significantly. In response, Caracas turned to Russia, as well as Iran and China, for diplomatic and economic aid. Russian energy companies and banks have since played a major role in Venezuela's exporting of oil. Fast forward to today, Russia is involved in a conflict with Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will only halt his country's military operation if Ukraine is stopped fighting and if Moscow's demands are met. On the other hand, Western governments have targeted Russia with a barrage of sanctions. The U.S. has imposed a ban on the exports of specific technologies to its oil refinery sector. Washington has also blacklisted over a dozen of Russian entities with ties to the country's military and defense sectors. Meanwhile, European Union has excluded 7 Russian banks from the global SWIFT payment system. The bloc has also banned 2 major news networks, namely Russia Today and Sputnik. And Germany has decided to freeze the Nord Stream 2 project. In a bid to punish Russia for attacking Ukraine, the US and its allies targeted Moscow's oil and gas sector via sanctions. And countries like Venezuela are potential substitutes. In addition, while the war in Ukraine continues unabated, Washington is paying closer attention to Moscow's allies in Latin America. Current and former U.S. officials believe that's because Washington thinks they could become security threats if the standoff with Russia deepens.
The U.S. is going to try to divide Russia from Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly enough, according to the White House itself, a lot of the sanctions imposed on Russia over this whole Ukraine nonsense are designed to target Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua, because those countries are also sanctioned by the U.S. And those countries are also dependent on Russia for aid. Russian support and aid is one of the main reasons why these countries have been able to overcome the sanctions to begin with. So in a sense, the U.S. is targeting these countries indirectly by hitting Russia. And I think people are not going to fall for it.
In a public speech on Thursday, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro stated that his country is open to discussing oil deals with investors from all around the world, including the U.S. In case Washington restricts the imports of Russian oil, Venezuela would be able to replace some of the lost supplies. The U.S. sees Latin America as an opportunity to advance its agenda among Latin American countries allied with Russia. But the U.S. is not that popular in Latin America for many reasons. In slightly less than 100 years, from 1898 to 1994, the U.S. intervened successfully to change governments in Latin America at least 41 times, or once every 28 months for an entire century.
The U.S. has launched a number of military coups to try to overthrow the Laughlin government in Venezuela. It has used all diplomatic and sanction means to try to do so. None of this has worked because the Venezuelan government has the backing of the people and also internationally has the support of countries like Russia, Iran, China, Nicaragua, Cuba, and many others that stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan government.
The United States has long interfered in the internal affairs of Nicaragua, a Latin American country it once occupied from 1912 to 1933 as part of the Banana Wars. Washington has imposed sanctions against Nicaragua's government and President Daniel Ortega's inner circle since 2018 when protests erupted in the country. Meanwhile, Cuba suffers from chronic shortages of electricity and food exacerbated by brutal U.S. sanctions. It also holds Washington responsible for stirring up violence in the country and blames its economic woes mainly on U.S. embargoes. And there is a long list of other countries in the region that have been victims of the U.S. sanctions and its intervention in their domestic affairs. While Washington seeks to find a substitute oil producer to fill in the place of Russia to further pressure Moscow by imposing stricter sanctions on its oil and gas, U.S.'s dark history continues to haunt it. Will Putin's Latin American allies stay loyal to him, or will they forget all hardship the U.S. has inflicted on their people for years?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon reached a record high for the month of February, jumping by nearly two-thirds over last February's level, according to official data released recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jenna McGuire, writer. This article is published under the heading, Amazon Deforestation Hit Record High in February, up 62% from 2021. Here's the story. Deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon reached a record high for the month of February, jumping by nearly two-thirds over last February's level, according to official data released recently. Satellite images released by the Brazilian space agency INPE's Deter Monitoring Program show 199 square kilometers, about 77 square miles, of the Amazon rainforest was lost to deforestation last month, the highest rate recorded in February since the agency began keeping records in 2015, and 62% increase from last year during the same month. Environmentalists find the data particularly alarming since February is considered the rainy season in the Amazon and generally sees the lowest rates of deforestation throughout the year. As indigenous communities and global environmentalists have been sounding the alarm on the imperiled rainforest, deforestation has skyrocketed under Brazil's right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. While the Amazon covers land in nine countries, approximately 60% of the forest lies in Brazil, which has reached its highest level of deforestation in more than a decade. This absurd increase shows the lack of policies to combat deforestation and environmental crimes in the Amazon driven by the current administration. The destruction just isn't stopping, said Romelo Batista of Greenpeace Brazil in a statement. Deforestation is predominantly caused by animal agriculture, soy production, logging, mining, and major construction, and has greatly impacted the nearly 1 million indigenous people from over 300 tribes who live in the Brazilian Amazon. We are going to be eating the rainforest in our burgers, Holly Gibbs, a land use scientist at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, told the Washington Post, adding, "This is our moment as Americans to step forward and leverage some pressure to save the world by helping to save the Amazon, which is critically important for the future of our planet." And research published recently in the journal Nature Climate Change found that the world's largest rainforest was quickly reaching its tipping point, and that the Amazon has been losing resilience since the early 2000s, risking dieback with profound implications for biodiversity, carbon storage, and climate change at a global scale.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajum. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the concept of justice and the concept of freedom, which stems from justice itself. When justice is applied, people get their freedom. We said for these concepts to be applied, we will need a ruler and a leader to make sure that these concepts are applied. Now, a ruler or a leader who wants to apply these concepts, he needs to have some certain traits himself. First of all, he needs to be a pious person. He needs to be a God-fearing person, first and foremost. If a leader, a governor, or a person in power, he does not fear the Almighty, the Creator, then surely he will oppress people. Surely he will take the rights of others. Now, that's something that we see today and we saw in history. The only person who this did not fit was Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam. For he was the most pious, he was the most God-fearing person that walked the planet Earth after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam, which made him a candidate, an ideal person to assume the concept of khilaf and to rule people. And for such piety and fearness of Allah, the Creator, the Almighty, Allah has appointed him to be the leader. Having said that, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, when he was in power and even before, he kept himself free from all the pollutions in which the rulers those days were involved in. Now, sometimes people have sincere intentions to serve the members of society and society itself, and they come with genuine love for society. But once they get to that position of power, the environment around them pollutes them, and then they divert from their course. Where Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, that did not happen to him. He did not take advantage of his noble descent, which most people do. He never accumulated wealth for himself through his position and through his office. On no occasion do we see Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi display pride, which we see many rulers and kings before him did, and even our modern time, you see those who are in power, they try to bring themselves and display pride. They think they are the rulers of the world, where that was not something that Amir al-Mu'mineen did. He remained aloof from all irrational and worthless things that sometimes we might, as human beings, indulge ourselves in. He never preferred his kinsmen and friends to others, which sometimes we do a lot, especially when we have position of power. And when I take position and assume power, the first thing I do is try to make sure that my friends and my family are well looked after. That wasn't Amir al-Mu'mineen's tradition or way or method of running things. He never nursed a grudge against any of his opponents. Like I said, to him, a friend and a foe were equal. And he even said, I don't care whether you're poor or you're weak. I will take the rights of the weak from those who are powerful. Because he wanted to serve the people, not the people serving him. Now, let us take a short break and then we will continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen's self-conduct and trying to run the system and run government and becoming a leader for people. And he was making himself an example, first and foremost, for others to lead and to follow. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi was indifferent to the things which he ate or drank, the dresses which he wore, and the houses in which he lived. He utilized these things only as much as they were absolutely necessary for him. Now we can see that whether it's me and you, or whether it's the kings and the rulers and those who have power, they always eat and drink and dress and have houses more than they require. I mean, even on a personal note, I can relate to that myself. I always have things, and I eat things and I drink things more than I require. Now, obviously, that's not a very commendable human trait. But Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi himself, he never done that. He did not take anything from the public treasury to meet his personal expenses, which you see today in governments and in secular systems and even in the modern world. They give the governors and they give the people in parliament or people in power or statesmen or what have you, they give them direct access to the country's treasury for them to spend on themselves, be it on trips, be it on pleasure, be it on what have you. They get a plastic card that has an unlimited amount of money that they can spend. And this money is the money of the people. So these governments give themselves the right to take from the treasury for their own personal expenses. Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi never did so. Never did he take a dime from the treasury of the Muslims for himself, nor for his family, nor for his friends. Although he could take at least as much as the governor of the province did. I mean, even we see that when Talha and Zubair came to him one day, he asked them, is this visit a personal visit? Or is it something that concerns the Muslim world and the nation? When they said to him, no, it is personal, he went and he turned off the candles and he lit other candles. And when they asked him why, he said, these candles are the property of the Muslims. If something concerns them, sure. But if it's personal, I have to light a candle from within my own. I can't give myself the right to take the rights of other people. Now, when you have such a personality, when you have a person in power that doing all these things for people, then people need to give him full allegiance. People need to give him the full cooperation in order for him to establish freedom and justice for them. When they don't, then the system will crumble and the rulers and the leaders in power will be oppressive and they will take their rights. Inshallah, we will continue this discussion in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
IRIB English Radio.